Today's session is on Leviticus. However, we have a couple of things in Exodus to finish off that are really, I think, so critical to what's going to come later in Leviticus and Numbers. And they're interesting too. So we should talk about them. So you remember this slide from yesterday? Here we've got. You remember that there were the two accounts of the tabernacle from 25 through to 31. And then again from 35 to 40, and in the middle we have the episode of the golden calf, which was such a tragedy, breaking as it was the first two commandments. And then we have Moses who intercedes there, and not only does God agree to continue his purpose with his people and not to destroy them all, but he also reveals himself to Moses in that wonderful incident. You remember when he covers Moses in the cleft of the rock and his back parts are seen, and the covenant that God had made with his people is renewed. And as a result of all that, God being made manifest to Moses, and Moses' appeal to God, and God's forgiveness of his people, God recommits to dwell amongst them, and so the tabernacle is built. If ever there would have been a doubt, this was the moment. And yet God's grace was such that he determined that he would continue with his plan to dwell with his people. And so the tabernacle was built, and there it is in chapter 35 to 40. So what we've got then is a duplicate narrative, and here are the two accounts, 25 to 31 and 35 to 40, and you'll notice that the order is similar but not quite the same, and this is a puzzle which I don't particularly have the answer to. It's almost the same but not quite, the order of the various elements in the tabernacle. And I just really here wanted to record the data and say, well, I can't explain the data, but that is the data, and maybe it's something that we can think about. One thing that you can notice if you look just at the start, for example, when the instructions are given on the left-hand side, you start with the ark, the table of showbread, the candlestick, and then you move to the tabernacle, the tent itself. So you can see that you're going from the most important and gradually working your way out. So you start with the ark. Now, when you actually come to build it on the right-hand side, Are you going to build the ark and then have the ark just sort of sat there in open space? Probably not. So instead, on the right-hand side for the construction account, you actually build the tent first so that you've got somewhere to put the ark once you've made it. So there is that kind of logic there to explain the difference in the order, at least at first. But that doesn't explain all the differences. I think the main lesson that we can learn from this, though, is the lesson that this is a doublet. You get all the instructions, and then you get all the fulfillment. And the fulfillment matches precisely, although the order is different, the fulfillment matches precisely what God had told Moses to build. And let's just get a sense of that by looking at Exodus 39 for a moment. Exodus 39 and verse 1, and we're just coming in somewhere in the middle of the construction account now. Of the blue, the purple, the scarlet, they made cloths of service to do service in the holy place and made the holy garments for Aaron, as the Lord commanded Moses. Look at verse 5, 39 verse 5, and at the end of that verse you'll see again, as the Lord commanded Moses. Look at the end of verse 7 and you'll see again, as the Lord commanded Moses. So the main point from the repetition of all this stuff on the right-hand side that we'd already had in the left is that Moses did exactly as the Lord commanded him. God said, do this, and lo and behold, Moses did it. And this is how it's supposed to be. This is how it's supposed to be in everything in our lives, in our building work for God, as we build our own lives and our ecclesias and our brotherhood, our community as a whole, to be a temple fit for him, that we do as the Lord has commanded us. And this kind of doubling here, it's exactly the same as the doubling that we had in Noah's Ark. You remember the flood narrative from Genesis 6 through to Genesis 8? And again, you've got all the instructions, and then you have an account that Noah did exactly as God commanded him. And you have the same kind of doubling effect. To illustrate that, point by point, Noah and Moses took God seriously. They took him at his word. They recognized that God was giving them a pattern for what they had to do, and so they did it. You know, there was no, well, I think I'll just innovate something here and come up with some scheme of my own. There was this sense of God knows best how we should do things, and therefore we'll do them that way, to the extent, of course, that he's given us guidance on things. So that, I think, is the main lesson here. So let's think for a moment about what the tabernacle is. And the tabernacle has different names, and those names themselves give us different lessons. And so one of the names is the sanctuary. And of course, a sanctuary, the word sanctuary, you know, it's related to the word sacred. Something which is sanctified, something which is set apart, something which is holy. And in Hebrew, the word sanctuary, the word that we have translated as sanctuary, one of the key terms for the tabernacle, means holy. Holy thing, place, or whatever. And you see all those awkward consonants there. So the first one, M-Q-D-Sh, that's the word for sanctuary. And you see that it's got Q-D-Sh in it, which is the word holy. Then the next one after the comma, Kodesh, that's the holy place. And then the next one, the holy of holies, that's got the word doubled in it. So we don't really see that in English, do we? Because the word sanctuary is a different English word to the word holy place and to the word most holy place. But in Hebrew, you've got the tabernacle itself was a holy place. Then there was the holy place within it that was even more holy. And then there was the holy of holies within that was holier still. So everything here to do with the tabernacle then, this is a holy thing. This is a special place for God. And that's what we have to make our lives. So that's one of the terms, and the second term is the one that we use most frequently, the term tabernacle, and of course that has to do with dwelling, the dwelling place, and the term tabernacle is normally used for the tented area, you know, that was made up of the holy place and the most holy place. So when we think of this term, then we move on from the idea of something sacred and holy to now thinking of the idea of dwelling, that God is leaving Mount Sinai with that, you know, incredibly impressive display of his glory and power flashing and thundering on Mount Sinai. He's leaving that and he's coming right into the very heart of his people to be with them, which is both scary and encouraging at the same time, isn't it? That God, so transcendent, so powerful, so far above us, should want to dwell so near to us. And the tabernacle captures perfectly those two images. You know, theologians talk about the immanence, the nearness, and the transcendence, the greatness, the farness of God. And in the tabernacle's sacredness, and yet the fact that it was also a home, like we have homes in their midst, captures those two aspects, doesn't it? And so inside the tabernacle, what do we have? Well, we have a table. Well, you have a table in your home, don't you? It had a lamp in it. It had a seat in it, a mercy seat. It had a stove of sorts. So you see that the tabernacle, there was a very real way in which the tabernacle was a kind of house, a kind of home for God, so that he might dwell in their very midst. So those are some of the house-like features that it had. And then the third term that's used to describe it is the tent of meeting. Now, some people think there were two tents of meetings, that the tabernacle itself is described as a tent of meeting, and that there was another tent of meeting further out in the camp where God appeared and talked to Moses. I'm not sure I'm not sure I'm persuaded of that, but some people think that. So just to mention it. Let's think about that term, the tent of meeting. Well, a tent, you know, we don't live in tents, we live in houses. A tent is a temporary residence, isn't it? And God dwelt, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were sojourners. The children of Israel were on a journey, and God here is dwelling in a tent with them. Isn't that astonishing that God should dwell in a tent? That God should go camping, as it were, with his people? And that very image of God going camping illustrates the extent to which he is prepared to be near us in our journey, doesn't it? Or you can think of the tabernacle as a kind of ancient RV, you know, with all the things that you would need in it, but it would, you know, it goes where you want to go. But it was not just a tent, it was a tent of meeting. It was to be a place of fellowship, an interface, a place where God and man would meet with each other, and when where the people as a whole would meet together and present themselves before him. So there's a sense of accountability there then, isn't there? And of course, the tabernacle had a service associated with it. There was a series of rituals and jobs that had to be done in order that God would continue to live amongst them. The tabernacle service. And so God had called Israel out of the house of bondage to now have as their center this new house, this house of God, this tabernacle. And instead of serving Pharaoh, they would now serve him. And instead of being slaves to Pharaoh, they would now worship him. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the word serve encapsulates both of those. You know, we talk about our Sunday service. We still use the word serve to mean worship, don't we? When we talk about a church service. And Hebrew was exactly the same. To serve can mean to be a slave, to make bricks for Pharaoh. And it can also mean to worship God. And so God is requiring the same word, but in a completely different dimension now from Israel. And we too then are to bring our service, our efforts, our energies, and our worship, the fruits of our lips, to worship and to serve him. There is one final thing about the tabernacle that I wanted to bring out, and that is the links between the tabernacle and the creation. So Moses ascends the mount to receive the instructions for the tabernacle on day 7. And God gives to him the instructions for the tabernacle are given in 7 particular speeches, and you'll see there the references where God says to Moses what the tabernacle is to consist of. And just as after the creation, God instituted the Sabbath, didn't he? He rested on the 7th day. It's very interesting that you remember there are the two tabernacle accounts. At the very end of the first tabernacle account, in Exodus 31, verses 12 to 17, what's the last thing that you have in that first tabernacle account? It's a reference to the importance of the Sabbath. And what's the very first thing that you have as the start of the next tabernacle account? It's a reference to the importance of the Sabbath. It's another link back to Genesis. And as the tabernacle is finally, all the bits are finally put together in Exodus 40, 7 times it says that Moses did all that final assembly stage just as the Lord commanded Moses. And I think I'm right in saying that there are 7 times in which in Genesis it says, and it was so. God and Moses see the work that has been done. The work of creation, the work of assembling the tabernacle. The work is finished and it's blessed. And those same words are used in both accounts then, again, suggesting this connection. And could it be, in fact, that the tabernacle is to be a kind of Garden of Eden for the Israelites? And so, just as you have the Garden of Eden as the special place where God is with men on the earth, and in Genesis 1 to 3, could it be that in a similar way you have the tabernacle, which is the kind of Garden of Eden in the midst of the camp of Israel, and that the whole thing is a microcosm of creation as a whole? So you have the cherubim on the veil and so forth in the tabernacle, just as you had the cherubim guarding the way in the Garden of Eden. The very idea of the voice of the Lord walking in the garden and the tabernacle of being God walking with his people. The presence of God amongst his people. The entrance to the east, the tree of life, the candlestick as a tree. Adam and Eve were commanded to serve and to keep the garden, and those same verbs are used to describe the tabernacle service too. So it's interesting then that we've got Israel representing the world at large then, don't we? And we have Israel having responsibilities towards the tabernacle, just as Adam and Eve had responsibilities in the Garden of Eden. And Israel, of course, were to represent God to the world at large, and they were to act that out in their own service. So it's it's fascinating that when Adam and Eve sin, of course, the curse that God, or the punishment that God makes, affects the entire creation, doesn't it? So what happens to them is mirrored in the wider world. And similarly, what happened at the flood and so forth. And God is using Israel in a similar way as a kind of microcosm of how he will deal with the world at large. And right at the heart of it, there is this tabernacle which stands there, in which God is present with his people. And he makes it very plain that if they obey his commandments, and this is now Deuteronomy 28 and so forth, that he will bless their world in very physical ways. And if they disobey him, their natural world will be cursed. Again, just as it was in the beginning. Well, that's all very interesting, but it's time to move on towards Leviticus. Let's just wrap up Exodus by reminding ourselves of those three phases in the book. So first of all, we have this people, don't we? We have those bones in the coffin in Egypt. They grow into a mighty nation, but they're still a nation under Pharaoh. God has to bring them out. He redeems them. He takes them to Sinai now through the wilderness. He covenants them to himself to be his people. He gives them his laws, and they say, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. And therefore, on that basis, God commands the tabernacle to be built so that he can live with them and so that he can be on the move with them in their very midst. And with that, then, we can move to Leviticus. So the sanctuary is standing and it's ready for use, and it's New Year's Day. This is a new beginning then. It's New Year's Day when the tabernacle is finally erected and God's presence comes and dwells on top of it, as it were, in Exodus chapter 40. Now what do we have to do? In order, given that we know that we are a sinful people and Israel are also a sinful people, we've had that illustrated well for us with the golden calf, what do we have to do in order not to chase God away, as it were? Given that we are a sinful people, how can God live with us? How can God live with them in their midst, given the rebellious nature that they had? Well, of course, that's where Leviticus comes in. And what do we read when we start in Leviticus 1? We read about the sacrifices. And this is it's on the basis of the forgiveness, which is sort of acted out and illustrated to us in the sacrifices, that God remains amongst his sinful people. So just as God made Adam and Eve and placed them in the garden and gave them responsibilities at the beginning of the book of Genesis, so now again, the tabernacle having been created, God having made the people his people, he gives them responsibilities and commandments to obey. And those commandments consist in, what do they consist in? They consist in a number of different things in the book of Leviticus. And this is a broad survey of what we find in Leviticus. And by the way, I decided that the easiest thing to do, I'm just going to put these slides up. Well, I'm not, but some kind brother will, apparently, put these slides up on the Manuka website. So if you want to, if you don't want to scribble stuff down, it should, hopefully, within a short while after the school, be available there if you want to have a look later on at any point. So first of all, we've got the sacrifices then in the first seven chapters, which explain to us how God will live amongst this sinful community, because they will offer these sacrifices that recognize his grace and their need of him. Now, in order to have sacrifices, you have to have a priesthood to offer them and to officiate. And so that's the thing that's described next then. The priesthood is consecrated in chapters 8 to 10. But the priesthood can't behave just however they like, as is illustrated by the example of Nadab and Abihu, which also occurs within those chapters. They too have to obey God's commands. Being a priest isn't a ticket to do whatever. That's their privilege to have that role, but they too have to obey God's commands, just as the people as a whole have to. Then there is a series of rules about purity that we'll look at in more detail later. And finally, in that section, the Day of Atonement. And you can see the Day of Atonement actually as part of chapters 11 to 15. Maybe that should say 11 to 16. It's as if the sinfulness of the Israelites, the persistent sinfulness, gradually sticks to the tabernacle, and it has to be purged every so often, once a year, in fact, on the Day of Atonement, of all that impurity that the Israelites cause throughout the course of the year. And the Day of Atonement is that wonderful occasion when all that is purged away, and obviously I suggested earlier that's the very heart of the Pentateuch, that particular ritual. Now, most of what's above that line then, up to and including the Day of Atonement, those are things that the priests have to be very active in officiating with. Whereas when we get into chapter 17 and onwards, it's much more about the community. The community in worship and the community in the world. And in those chapters, you can see a lot of exhortation to the common people about how they should behave, how they should treat their neighbours, and so forth. Now, that's a broad generalization, to see the top bit as being more about things that the priests were involved in, and the latter bit as more things about the common people in worship and in the world. I mean, it's broadly true, but you're going to find things at the top that are about the common people too, and you're also going to find things about the priests in the second half. But I think it's of some use as a generalization. Well, how can we characterize the theme of Leviticus as a whole? Well, it's got to be this concept, hasn't it? The concept of holiness and uncleanness. So let's think first of all about holiness. So words related to holiness occur more than 150 times in the book of Leviticus. That's more than a fifth of their total occurrences in the Bible are in this book. So what does holy mean? Well, we normally say set apart, don't we? separate, set apart. And that's true, of course. It does mean that. The only problem with that is that it's slightly a negative definition, isn't it? It's almost saying, so when we say God is holy, it's almost to say, we can almost be thinking about that of what God isn't, rather than what God is. But holiness also captures what God is fundamentally. You know, God is holy. And what does that mean then? You know, he's unique. He is separate in that sense. He's beyond comparison to any of us in that way. He's morally pure. He's complete. He's perfect. He is without sin, obviously. So holiness, I think, speaks of perfection then, in a sense, at least when we talk about it in relation to God. It's the supremely God-like characteristic. Holiness is God-likeness in the sense that God is perfect and without blemish, without imperfection. So let's take a look at a couple of passages here. Let's go to Leviticus 19, first of all. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, Ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. So you see where holiness originates then. It originates with God. It's supremely what God is. Everything that God is what is captured by the term holy. And this differs, you know, because the other cultures around Israel, they used to use the word holy too. But they would use it, and, you know, there might be a holy stream or a holy forest or something. You know, as if a stream of itself could have some property to it, you know, sort of a numinous quality to it, which it would have certain powers or whatever. But of course, there's nothing like that in the Bible. God is holy. It's what God is. And we have to reflect that. What did it say? Ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. So we have to try to be everything that God is. That's our calling then. Be ye therefore perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect. And when you think of one of the aspects of holiness as being perfection, completeness, you can see how what Jesus said, in a way, came straight out of a concept that was in Leviticus. Let's go over to chapter 20 and verse 7. Sanctify yourselves, therefore, which of course means make yourselves holy. It's exactly the same original word, R-Q-D-S-H word again. Sanctify yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God, and ye shall keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord which sanctify you. I am the Lord which makes you holy. So God is holy, and all other holiness, such as we might hope to attain to it, is derived from him. It's bequeathed to us from him. He is the one who sanctifies us, who makes us holy, and we now have to try to live in a holy way because that's what he is. Because he is a holy God. And on into verse 26 of that chapter. And ye shall be holy unto me, for I the Lord am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. And that's a graphic word, isn't it? I have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. So here's our idea of being set apart now, isn't it? Being separate. This is the calling that God has given us. And one more reference in this little chain, chapter 22 and verse 32. Neither shall ye profane my holy name. That's, of course, the opposite of something being holy. But I will be hallowed or made holy among the children of Israel. I am the Lord which hallow you, that brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. You see, again, there's this reciprocal thing going on, isn't there? It's like a little circle here. I will be hallowed among the children of Israel. I am the Lord which hallow you. I've hallowed you, so you hallow me. Now, when we think more widely about these categories of holy and clean and unclean, what we're dealing with, of course, is the concept of boundaries, isn't it? That God is marking off things, that God is setting boundaries. Now, the same God who carried out creation by dividing the light from the darkness, by dividing the waters above from the waters below, he made boundaries there, didn't he? He made distinctions. He said to the sea, you shall not pass beyond this point. From the book of Job. God asks us to organize our life in the same way. To think in terms of what is in the bounds and what is out of bounds. What is inappropriate. To think in terms of holiness and cleanness, to make distinctions. And of course, the law makes distinctions of all types, distinctions of place, the most holy place, the holy place, the unclean area outside the camp, distinctions in terms of time, a holy convocation unto the Lord, a holy assembly, a special assembly, when everyone would have the opportunity to come apart from whatever it was they were doing and to think about the things of God. A holy day, the Sabbath to the Lord. There are boundaries in terms of people, priests, Levites, the high priest, the common people, the unclean people, the strangers and foreigners, the lepers. To make distinctions in terms of things, in terms of habit, actions which cause uncleanness and actions which can bring about sanctification and cleansing. So that's all very relevant then, isn't it, to our own lives then, in terms of thinking about what fits and what doesn't fit. That God has called us to be a holy people for him, that he has severed us from the world, and that we need to behave in a correspondingly appropriate way. That it's right that we should agonize about distinctions and what the right distinction to make is. God wants us to go through that process of distinction making, just as he went through it in order to bring about creation. Because that's how we shall be ourselves part of God's creative process as he prepares his new creation. He wants to do it in exactly the same way. By us making distinctions in life between clean and unclean, between sacred and profane. By us cleaving to him and seeking the sanctification that he can bring. Now, you can think, really, of a kind of chain here. So you can think of holiness at one extreme and things which are common or clean in the middle, and then things which are unclean on the other side. Now, if you have something which is holy, you can profane it, and then it will become common, or not holy anymore. And if you take that thing, then something which is normal, which is not holy, and then you pollute it, then you have something which is unclean. So you see how we're going in steps here. Now, let's suppose we take the unclean thing now and we cleanse it. Then, of course, it becomes clean. It becomes normal. And let's suppose now we take that thing which is clean and we sanctify it, and oh, it becomes holy. So there's a very clear system here, isn't there? A very clear structure. And then within those categories, there are different degrees of uncleanness. According to how unclean something is, that will determine what exactly the procedure is in order to render it clean again. So some things take more cleaning than others. It's just like doing the washing up, isn't it, with pans baked in the oven and things that just need a quick wipe off. It's exactly the same here. And there are different degrees of holiness. There is a most holy place and there is a holy place, and in a different sense, the whole tabernacle is holy. There's a sense in which the whole of Israel are a holy people to the Lord, but that's a different kind of holiness to the holiness of the high priest, who had a greater intensity of holiness, if you like. So there are grades all the way in these categories, which is quite interesting. Well, we talked plenty about holiness, and there on the right-hand side, you can see the terms of cleanness and uncleanness. So, clean, about a third of the biblical occurrences are in the book of Leviticus, and unclean, more than a half of the occurrences are here in Leviticus. Well, we started to talk about this already then, so here are some categories for us. Holy, clean, and unclean. And this just illustrates in the middle column with respect to space. There is the Holy of Holies, the holy place, and the courtyard. They're all holy, but some are more holy than others. And there is the camp, which is clean, and then there is the area outside the camp, which is unclean, where unclean people have to go. That's where the lepers are. That's where polluted Israelites would be. That's where non-Israelites are. And so you can see on the right-hand side the different grades of people there. And of course, the high priest has on his forehead holiness to the Lord that indicates the special calling that he had. And so for each of those, for example, for each of those different levels of holiness within people, there will be different restrictions upon them in terms of marriage. So the priests had different restrictions in terms of who they could marry to what the Levites had and to what normal Israelites had. There would be distinctions between the mourning rites that were allowed, you know, when someone had died, for these different groups of people. So it was a very intricate and elaborate system, but what was it designed to teach? It was designed to teach this sense of separation, this sense of making distinctions, this sense of the distinctiveness of God, and what a honor and privilege, and also what a thing of moment it is, what a thing of significance it is to come near to him when he is so holy. So all this system then teaches you to make God special, doesn't it? You know, in simple terms, to make God special in your life. That's what it's about. And it's a very elaborate, complicated system to do that, but that's basically what it does. And all these laws that, you know, they can seem elaborate and dense to us, they're all basically about that principle, aren't they? About understanding God's specialness and about us trying to attain it and realizing that that's the way to go. That's the right way. And it's very interesting if you compare some of the other cultures in the ancient world, because they had quite elaborate laws as well, some of them. But their laws, you know, in contrast, they're very concerned, for example, with economics. And there are some laws, obviously, in the Bible that relate to that in terms of compensation when people are wronged and so forth. But, you know, the focus is very different. This is what the focus is on. The focus is on the uniqueness of God, his perfection and identity, and our sense of how important it is that we have him in the midst and that we keep him there. And that we do that by approaching him in the right way and asking him to sanctify us and to make us holy. To make God special and to change our ways as a result so that they match his. Now I've had a blank here. Am I supposed to stop at 10-2 or 5-2? 5-2, okay. So we shall do a little like we did yesterday. We'll leave a little bit of Leviticus over for tomorrow. But let's have a quick look now at the offerings. So here they are. So this is now the first 8 chapters or so of Leviticus, and I've got more comments on these than the other parts of Leviticus. So let's have a quick look at this. So you've got 2 accounts of the offerings. The first account then runs roughly from Leviticus 1 to 6, and that's addressed to the people. You know, if I'm wanting to make an offering, these are the things that I need to think about. These are the types of offerings as they relate to me and what I would need to bring. Then there's a second account of the same offerings again with respect to the priests. What things, you know, it's almost like a little checklist for the priests that we've got on the right-hand side. So we go through the material again, but the focus is slightly different in the second case. And also the order is a little bit different. The order is different in that the peace offering for the priests is put down at the end, in fifth place, instead of in third place, where it comes in the first list. So the first list then is for the people, and the first three offerings there are grouped together, I think, because these are all food offerings which are a sweet savour to the Lord. So they're all put together there. Whereas on the right-hand side, the peace offering is moved last, because I think that relates to the holiness of the food, of the meat, that's being offered, because the peace offering is the one where you sat down and actually had a fellowship meal. And the person itself who offered his peace offering would eat the peace offering as his meal there and then at the point of offering. So that was the least holy with respect to the meat, because the offerer who was, you know, was the least clean in terms of our high priest way down to our common people, he was going to be eating so much of that meal as a fellowship meal. So that's why the suggestion is that that's why that's put in last place. And the order's slightly different with the priests. Now, again, lots of ancient cultures offered sacrifice. So the act of offering a sacrifice itself isn't what differentiated the Jews from other peoples. I mean, I'm sure there were cultures that didn't offer sacrifices, but my point is that there were plenty of other cultures who did offer sacrifices. And, you know, superficially, some of the sacrifices may even look somewhat similar to these in some respects. But what's different, what's completely different, is the rationale for offering them. So, you know, you can do something, and this, you know, I suppose this relates to, you know, being a good living person, doesn't it? And is that enough? Is it enough just to offer a sacrifice and not know why you're doing it? Is it enough to offer a sacrifice thinking that your God is hungry and, you know, needs some food, so you bring him some food? Or needs to drink some blood, so you shed some blood? Or that the God is angry and needs to be appeased in that kind of way. You know, is there the Aztecs and why they offered sacrifice and they thought that taking the blood of the sacrifice into them would be life-giving for them, I think, didn't they? My memory is a bit hazy now on Aztec sacrifice, but I think there was something about that. There were some cultures who did that anyway. But here, the sacrifice is something which is provided by God. And remember, in Leviticus 17, God says, I have given the blood to you to make atonement. And where does the blood come from then? If the blood represents the life comes from God. It was God who made the animal in the first place. So God provides the means, and we just have to do the right thing. And God has provided the Lord Jesus Christ, and we have to identify with him as our representative. And you can see that, can't you, as the hand is placed upon the animal as it's slain, that sense of identification with the animal. And that's what's unique about these sacrifices in the Bible, as opposed to what some of the other cultures round about were doing. This concept of sin and of forgiveness and of cleansing. Well, there are some notes there about what I have on the slides here about each of the offerings and what they were used for. I was going to run through that quickly, but time's not going to allow us to do that. So let's skip all that. Hopefully it is going to be on the website if anyone wants to have a look. But let's finish off this class with some thoughts here. So I've already sort of talked to this, but here's just a slide that summarizes it. So the term to make atonement, which of course is a very one that's used frequently in Leviticus, then is this word, and scholars debate about what it means, because depending on which word you think it relates to, you could get a different meaning out of it. So some people think it comes from a word that means to cover. So thinking of the covering of sins, and you think of the mercy seat as a covering for the ark. There's an Akkadian word that means to wipe, to cleanse. And so some people think the word comes from that idea. And again, the idea of sins being cleansed, it's a scriptural idea, isn't it? So I don't think any of these are, it's interesting that the word that God should have chosen should have all these associations with it. And there's another word that is used, which means to pay a ransom. And you can see that in Exodus 21. We're almost done here. Just give me 2 seconds. Exodus 21 and verse 30. We're just coming here in the middle of this. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatever is laid upon him. Now you see the idea of a ransom for your life, and that's a word that looks very much like this verb to make atonement. So there's that connection too. But the key thing, and it's so important that I want as our final passage, just to go to this passage in Leviticus 17. This point that there's nothing that we have that we did not receive, and that this whole system, this whole system of God dwelling with his people, that was his idea. He wanted to do that. He wanted to live with us. And he provided the mechanism by which that would be made possible. Leviticus 17 and verse 11. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the souls. So there was this is part of the blood prohibition. So they were to treat blood in an extremely precious way, weren't they? Why was that? Because it represented the life. Where did life come from? Life comes from God. And God wanted that blood to be used for one purpose only, to be completely distinctive for them. God gave it to them to make atonement and as an illustration for them of his forgiving, cleansing power, and of his provision in making sacrifice for sin. So let's leave it there, and we'll pick up with a little bit more Leviticus and then some Numbers in tomorrow's class.